connected more to the linear thinking of Jarl Mahora than he did Skald Thatcher, and so was unlikely to suspect Idris of anything. Though if the Watchman called for it, the operative would not hesitate to kill Idris where he stood. The Watchman was another problem entirely, as the young man was more than capable of piecing together the role Idris had played in Skald Thatcher's escape, and it was up to Idris himself to give the commander no reason to suspect him. Unferth, the Skald operative who had been primarily responsible for organizing Thatcher's resurrection and escape, had taken great pains to cover their tracks. Idris himself only had to allow it, but in so doing was himself party to the tragedies that had resulted. He believed, just as much as narrative strategy hardliners like Skald Omar, that to aid Thatcher in transforming himself into the beast that was now called Loki had set him apart from the rest of humanity's defenders. Idris might still serve faithfully aboard the Bright Lance, but forever would he be a man who betrayed his own, even if he thought it in the service of the greater good. He had managed to avoid Skald Heart without drawing attention to his avoidance, given that the sniper was often away on missions with the other operatives. Weeks or even months could pass without the Bright Lance hosting the Special Forces warriors. Of all the men in the Allfather's army, it was the sniper who would have been able to read the Resurrectionist's body language and would know him as a traitor in an instant. Idris considered for a moment the coded message he'd received from the traitors, the first and only communication he'd had with them in the years since first helping them escape aboard the Prax gunship. It had only been three words, but they spoke volumes, and while Idris knew little of Loki's plan, he understood the goal of Ragnarok. His heart thundered in his chest at the thought of a grand conflict, a final rest, and he worked to calm himself. "They are coming," said Idris, repeating the message Loki had sent him, saying it to Wallace and the Watchmen as if they were his own words, and when he did it, felt as if he'd divested himself of a tremendous burden. They were coming, which meant that nothing else mattered. There was only the way forward. "These biomass raids, in my opinion, are twofold endeavors," Idris continued, feeling much more in control of his mannerisms and body language now that he was giving his briefing. The traitorous guilt finally yielding to the task at hand, given a tangible legitimacy now that it was being spoken aloud. "The Extinction Fleet is gathering biomass in order to effect a significant invasion force, to breed enough ships and swarms to mount another attempt to overwhelm us. However, I believe that these raids have also been field tests, similar to the behavior exhibited on Heorot." "The stealth tech," said Skald Wallace flatly. "Yes," nodded Idris. "As you know, each Horde ship has an Alpha Garm that functions as the swarm leader. Reports from Marines in the field, in addition to what autopsy results we were able to glean from recovered corpses, indicate that the Alpha Garm are capable of exerting a sort of psychic pressure that helps the stalkers and feeders enjoy a degree of camouflage. However, in light of the discoveries on Trillicum, I believe that the Alpha Garm are not the source of that psychic pressure, but simply a conduit." The men were silent, and Idris pressed on. "Marine Sharif, before succumbing to the blackout, discovered a human skull and complete brain that was hardwired into the central system of the biovessel," said Idris, as he brought up images on his datapad and those of the other two men, directing their attention to several still photos and a short video of the skull fragments in the lab. "In his rage, the Marine destroyed the brain and then wreaked catastrophic damage on the central system before perishing from a combination of shrapnel and a series of strokes, a common demise for those blacking out for the first time. However, we recovered enough brain matter that we could analyze it on the cellular level. What we found was eerily familiar."
"Grendel is back," muttered Skald Wallace as he scrolled through the photos until he was looking at a relief image of several tissue samples.
"After a fashion," agreed Idris, and his eyes flitted to the Watchman, for a moment recalling the trauma of first discovering that Grendel's power could rob the Marines of their ability to resurrect, and of the old Watchman dying with a scream over and over
until it was agreed that he would be allowed to remain dead. The brain from the Horde ship was packed with Garm cells that were identical to those found inside Grendel, with a heavy concentration on the sending cells. The Alpha Garm that accompany the Horde ships have a more balanced distribution of cells. It is my theory that the human brain is the source of the psychic emissions that baffle our long-range technology, or more specifically, our mind's ability to interpret the data of our own instruments. The Alpha Garm draws that emission and focuses it in a highly concentrated way to give an advantage to the ground swarms. In short, the hive mind has found a way to use human brains to broadcast a psychic signal into our minds that obfuscates ships and swarms with varying degrees of potency.
"Where did the Garm get all these human skulls and brains?" asked Wallace, with an edge of incredulity in his voice. "If they could breed humans for skull and brain harvesting, then we'd have encountered something like this or worse much sooner."
"It stands to reason that the enemy would have had a number of opportunities to harvest freshly killed corpses on a piecemeal basis over the years, in addition to the possibility that there are prisoners being kept far behind the front lines. The Garm adapt, as it is said, and the idea that there are experiments being done on captured humans is not so far-fetched," answered the Watchman before turning away from the Scald and facing Idris, his tone implying that he expected Idris to not only have an answer, but a solution. "When you say varying degrees, do you believe that different Marines and tech officers respond to the psychic emissions differently?"
"We have statements and combat records from multiple engagements with Horde ships and Alpha Garm that indicate this is the case. In short, it works on some men more profoundly than others," responded Idris. Anticipating the commander's next line of questions, he added, "I believe that we can use these findings to create a solution in advance of the renewed invasion force, as most of their ships will likely be equipped with such hideous technology."
Idris took a deep breath, preparing himself for their reactions, and then looked at each man in the eyes before continuing. Marine Ajax, often referred to by the grunts as the Bloodhound, was exposed to the Garm cells when he first faced Grendel on Heorot. As you know, over time he was able to harness these cells to enable him to, in a way, track high-functioning Garm organisms by instinct. His body, by whatever stroke of biological luck, was able to cope with the Garm cells, incorporating them into his overall nervous system without compromising his consciousness or ability to resurrect, said Idris, knowing that he was dancing on the razor's edge of being discovered. Given that he'd been intentionally keeping Ajax in a state of limbo, having faked the failed resurrection attempts. With Ajax off the board, the beast, Loki, could orchestrate the cascading events that would trigger Ragnarok, a full-blown apocalypse. Idris had been introducing trace chemicals that caused Ajax to suffer fatal strokes, rendering him brain dead every time he was resurrected. Since it was Idris himself who was responsible for investigating the issue, there was little risk of discovery. "I recommend that we attempt to replicate what could best be described as the Bloodhound effect, and expose a percentage of our Marines and tech officers to the Garm cells. By harvesting the cells that are now part of Marine Ajax's DNA, it is possible that his transmutation of them will eliminate the negative effects that they had on others," said Idris, looking pointedly at the Watchman. "Like your predecessor."
"As I understand it, Ajax cannot fully resurrect. He is essentially brain dead every time you bring him back, correct?" asked Scald Wallace.
"That is true," answered Idris, steeling himself for the turn. "However vegetative his state may appear, the Garm cells remain active. Though his conscious mind is inert, the alien cells are still active, sending and receiving. If we can successfully replicate his abilities in enough of our forces, that could enable tech officers to pierce the veil broadcast by the Horde ships and allow warriors on the ground to push through the emissions of the Alpha Garm. These are second-generation Garm cells, having already passed from Garm to human once before, and now human to human, transmuted by our own rather protean genetic makeup. As such, these new hounds should be able to resurrect the way Ajax was before his tragic encounter on Tancred. The more swiftly and with effective prejudice we can respond to these biomass incursions, the longer we should be able to delay the Extinction Fleet's next attempt upon the Bifrost, assented Scald Wallace. A counter to the enemy's tech is worth risking lives. Reaper's Lantern is near the end of a rest and refit. We will tap parts of their tech crew, and Gorgon Company has been serving in their legions, hard men who will not shirk from their duty. We will pull the first test group from their ranks.
Recruitment into the Allfather's military has been in steady decline, year after year, as has the increase in non-suitable candidates for Einherjar status, observed the watchman as he stood, prompting Idris to stand more firmly at attention, and Scald Wallace to rise from his own seat. Whether the time we buy ourselves is months, weeks, or even days, all the more warriors we will have to hold the line. The United Humanity Coalition is, by its nature, a fractured union, susceptible to corruption and avarice, though with the undeniable escalation in Garm activity, our representatives have been able to secure more equipment and raw materials allotments. While we may not share all the details with UHC Command, a heavily censored version of developments will perhaps speed up the arrival of those allotments. The Extinction Fleet had indeed effected some degree of change in its war effort, from the push to seize Raqqa to these biomass raids. In truth, I am growing suspicious that much of the purpose behind the renewed assault upon Raqqa was to misdirect us from the discovery of the downed Horde ship, or at the very least, giving its internal systems time to self-destruct, which it ultimately accomplished. You are free to proceed, Specialist Idris. I will ask that all ship's captains and marine commanders provide volunteers for the first round of tests. Based on performance, we will reassess and increase the volunteer pool. Good day, gentlemen. As abruptly as it began, the meeting was adjourned, and Idris found himself standing in the body forge of the Bifrost only a few hours later. The heavy warship Reaper's Lantern was also docked at the battle station, and volunteers from Gorgon Company would be arriving within the hour. While the body fort aboard the Brightlance was the personal dominion of Idris, as a resurrectionist, he had full access privilege upon the Bifrost, as the facilities on board the station were much more extensive than any of the warships. It was here that the Torques of the men slain by Grendel had come to rest, including the last surviving Torque of Marine Ajax. Idris lifted the Torque of Ajax and slotted it carefully into the receiver of the resurrection pod. He typed in the activation commands and then took hold of the two remote assist servo arms that specialists used to reconstruct the clone bodies from the base blocks of organic tissue. As he worked, Idris was keenly aware of the tissue samples he had collected from the liquefied human brain recovered from Trillicum. They were already mixed with delivery fluids and weighted in hypoinjectors that were neatly lined up in rows on his mobile utility station. Once the Marines and tech officers arrived, he would be injecting them with the Trillicum sample-based hypos, while masquerading as if doing so with cocktails made from the cells of a resurrected, yet vegetative, Ajax. It was a risk, he knew, but the only way to balance his conflicting loyalties. The warriors of the Allfather legitimately needed a way to counter the Garm stealth tech, though he couldn't very well allow the transmuted cells of Ajax to be unleashed. One marine hero with a direct connection to Loki had been difficult enough, and from what he'd gathered, the doomed marine had come close to thwarting the traitor's plans. If hundreds of marines and tech officers suddenly found themselves connected not only to the hive mind, but the beast Loki as well, the schemes and the sacrifices that made them would be uncovered prematurely. The Einherjar must be made stronger to fight the wolves at the gate, but not at the cost of losing the window to ignite Ragnarok. This was the middle path, Idris was sure of it. If he could facilitate the creation of an entire cadre of bloodhounds, the armies of the Allfather would have their counter, and the playing field would be returned to level. No one outside Loki's circle of traitors knew that a second hive mind, the Beta, had ever existed. The Marines of Hydra Company had witnessed Garm-Intercene War on Heorot. The official judgment was that the Hive Mind was cleaning up the evidence, ensuring that the Einherjar escaped with as little intel as possible. While that was indeed true, they could not have known that it was in fact the first blows of a civil war between the Alpha Hive Mind and the Beta, a war which the Beta Hive Mind lost. This made Ajax the only Marine with Garm cells from the Beta Hive, and the only Bloodhound who would be able to track Loki and his hybrids. It had something to do with which breed the cells came from. In the case of Ajax and Loki, both of them had Grendel as a common ancestor, as it were, so inherited the dual awareness of both hive minds as well as each other. No, Ajax had to be kept out of the fight, until the precise moment that giants and wolves took the field against the warriors of man. That time was not yet come, though the need for other men to be hounds was immediate. If his theories were correct, and the Garm cells took root, the new crop of hounds would be connected only to the Alpha hive mind. In fact, given that the cells were from a converted human brain, and likely third or even fourth generation, there was significant probability that the hounds would only have a connection with the Horde ship and accompanying Alpha Garm broods. He doubted the new hounds would be able to accomplish the feats of tracking Ajax once had, so narrowly focused and specialized the cells were that they would ingest. They would be bloodhounds indeed when on the scent of the Horde ships, though just as oblivious as any other Marine with regards to the other broods. As Idris carefully crafted the body of Ajax, volunteers from Gorgon Company began to file into the waiting area just outside the laboratory. From the corner of his eye, Idris recognized Marine Jorah, one of the few men not of Hydra who had faced Loki. Like the rest who entered that room, he had died and been reborn without his memories of the encounter. Gorgon was a decorated company and had been part of Task Force Grendel in addition to being present at Heorot. They would do. Six. Monster Swamp. The murky black water swirled thickly around Jorah's armored waist as he trudged through one of the many fetid bayous that were the defining feature of planet Odessa. While the small world was not without a multitude of natural landscapes, low mountain ranges, an assortment of shallow saltwater seas, and a number of modest forested regions, it was the vast wetlands for which the planet was known. The planet was thought to have little value. The waters were brackish, the trees twisted and gnarled things, and there was little in the way of precious resources. While these conditions were undesirable for regular colonization, they were ideal for service as a prison planet. Odessa Corporation secured the rights to the world, renamed it, and soon was shipping in life sentence convicts to serve their terms on the rugged world. It had probably been a somewhat quiet world, thought Jorah, as he put one booted front in front of the other, despite the powerful suction of the mud that was up to his shins underneath the water, until Odessa prospectors discovered Ink Rock. Ink rock was a crude substance when pulled from the depths of the planets upon which it had formed, yet it was capable of being turned into a multitude of fuels depending on the refinery process employed. The entire wetlands region of Odessa, nearly 60% of the planet, was revealed to have massive ink rock deposits lying in wait below the treacherous waters and thick foliage. Extracting ink rock was a complicated process, made all the more so by the unique difficulties of wetlands drilling. The conditions of the environment prevented the more high-end equipment from being used, and Odessa found it necessary to rely on older models and methods. It was dangerous work, as the wetlands were rife with parasites, predators, and unpredictable landscapes. Thankfully for the corporation, they already had a population of convicted lifers to fill out the labor force. Now that Command was aware of the Extinction Fleet's campaign of biomass raids, the enemy Horde ships could no longer operate with impunity. Their clandestine feeding raids were subject to even more swift response and punishment. The discovery on Trillicum had changed everything, both for the Einherjar and the Garm forces, as it allowed the Marines to rob the Garm of their stealth tech. The Garm adapt, Marines overcome. Jorah had been the first to volunteer when the call came down. He had lost his memories before, entire campaigns forgotten with the loss of a torque, though the sinister use of bombs by the traitors to wipe the minds of those who faced them on Tancred was still a fresh wound. Perhaps, he'd thought, becoming a bloodhound would further empower him to strike back. He'd approached every engagement since Tancred with a sense of vengeance,
as if every garm he slew went towards balancing the scales of an already burdened soul. The Reaper's Lantern, with its new cadre of hounds, some serving as tech officers on the heavy warship and others like Jorah serving as marines on the ground, was on the hunt yet again. The marine admitted that it was something of a nightmare to have the garm in his mind, a tangible psychic presence that he could hone in on when he focused himself. This was the fifth such engagement that the Lantern had been sent to intercept, and as the Extinction Fleet stepped up the frequency and boldness of their raids, so too did the Einherjar rise to meet them. More hounds were being created every day, hundreds of men who were dispersed throughout the vast military forces of the Allfather, and their newfound powers had proven highly effective. In this case, a spine frigate had hurled itself against the meager orbital defenses of Odessa and created an opportunity for the Horde ship to enter the planet's atmosphere. Now, as the Allfather's warship, Reaper's Lantern, chased the spine frigate through the nearby system, it was up to the legions of marines deployed from the holds of the Lantern to purge the alien menace from the planet's surface. If they moved quickly enough and engaged the Garm with sufficient force, they could destroy the Horde ship before it made its escape. That was the devilish brilliance of the hive mind stratagem, as the spine frigate was indeed far too dangerous to leave unattended. And yet, with the Lantern drawn off to fight it, the Horde ship, once its hold was full, had a significant chance of escaping into orbit. It was a bloody grind of a strategy. The hive mind gambling that the caloric expenditure of the raid would yield a positive return after it consumed what was seized. The same scenario unfolding on Odessa was playing out across human space, with nearly every planet in modest proximity to the battlefront being subjected to such raids. While a planet like Odessa might be only worth the weight of its Inkrock deposits to the UHC, to the Garm it represented a world teeming with biomass. The Garm likely cared not at all about the Inkrock, or the massive drilling operations and penal workforce, who, by the way, had chosen now of all times, Jorah laughed to himself grimly, to revolt en masse. "You find present conditions to be amusing?" asked Hart, the Scald Special Forces operator assigned to accompany Gorgon Company on their sweep of the southernmost quadrant of the vast wetlands region. "Human space is being hit all across the battlefield by Garm raiding parties, which increase in size and daring with every new assault, with all signs pointing to a pending attack of titanic proportions," observed Jorah, as he used the barrel of his pulse rifle to move aside a low-hanging tree branch so that he and the Scald sniper could continue forward. "And yet, while Gorgon Company marches into the jaws of our enemy, a common prison riot is what occupies the time and attention of the UHC. Odessa Corporation has no interest in halting Inkrock operations over something so pedestrian as alien invasion," Hart laughed, the sound of it striking Jorah as rather affected, as if the sniper had honed his sense of humor in the mirror for the sake of fostering camaraderie rather than it being genuine mirth. "Let the Einherjar battle the beasts while UHC troopers shoot riders until the convicts lose their appetite for revolt and return to their duties. Scald, I cannot tell whether you were making a joke or observing the truth, and I am distressed that either is perfectly appropriate," snorted Jorah, as he recalled the sight of several dozen UHC troop transports sailing overhead during Gorgon's initial deployment, each of the ships heading for different penal compounds with a belly full of UHC troopers on a mission to quell the riots and put the convicts back to work. "If it were me, I'd put a gun in the hand of every man on this planet and point them at the enemy." "Men are ill-suited to combat with the Garm," responded Hart, his affected mirth gone in an instant as he unslung his rifle and peered down the scope, keeping it impossibly steady as he continued to trudge through the swampy terrain. "Better to do this on our own and let the UHC play the game of civilization without distraction. Good men fought and died with us on Tancred. Had I not seen it for myself, I would be inclined to agree with you," said Jorah, before checking his flanks to make sure that he and his 14-man fighting force was keeping pace with the rest of Gorgon as the company marched in a broad formation across the quadrant. "I think in our years of war we have forgotten the strength of men." Hart remained silent for a moment as the marines pressed onwards, as if considering Jorah's statement. After several moments, with only the sounds of insects and the sucking slush of armored bodies moving across the bayou, Hart turned slightly to speak.
"Do you recall much of your life before becoming a Marine?" asked Hart, his voice having lost some of its usual hard edge. Jorah did not have an answer at first. He found as he attempted to delve into his memories, there was little to be found there but his time as an Einherjar. That, he quickly realized, was likely the reaction that Hart had been going for. Jorah was no different from the rest of the men who wore the mantle of humanity's defenders, who, and whatever he was before the war, had been lost to the Body Forge, and there was no telling what he'd given up. Perhaps he'd been in love once, as a great many of his fellow Marines yet clung to tattered memories of wives and girlfriends, though he could not recall. Certainly he had family and friends, and likely a career, and yet all such things had been overwritten with military stratagems, combat tactics, and skill with the equipment of war. All but the basest elements of his personality remained. The rest of him was simply a Marine. A walking rifle, a paper target, a war machine, with only the most rudimentary of emotions and unique characteristics. "You grasp my point, then, Jorah of Gorgon Company," said Hart, the edge having returned to his voice. As the sniper returned his attention to the ground ahead of them, he added, "We have but one purpose, and no matter what horrors we face, the Body Forge awaits most of us. When a man dies, a real man, humanity has lost something, lost someone that it can never get back." Jorah let Hart's words hang in the air, as he had no rebuttal or disagreement. The sniper was right, of course, as so few of the marshals who went into the tunnels with the Einherjar on Tancred had emerged from that battle alive. Other than poor and doomed Ajax, every other Marine awakened in the Body Forge, ready to fight again. The marshals stayed dead, their loss felt by those they'd left behind. Perhaps, thought Jorah, as he suddenly caught movement out of the corner of his eye, it was a blessing that so few human beings possessed the precise sight profile and physiology required to be a Marine. Even with the right physical and mental properties, only a select few humans were able to cope with the Body Forge, and many of the aspirants ended up as simple warrior drones aboard ships and the Star Fortress Bifrost. Gorgon Company had been dispatched to purge the southernmost quadrant of the Odessan wetlands, and Jorah had no doubts that if a UNC detachment had been assigned to accompany them, that plenty, if not all, of the human troopers would meet their deaths in this stinking bayou. Hart was right. Best not to waste the lives of men who still had them to live. Better instead to march the Einherjar into the nightmare. His own death would count for little, thought Jorah. And humanity did not have the lives to spare. "Well, Hound, what lies ahead?" asked Hart, the question almost feeling rhetorical as the sniper peered through his scope. Jorah flexed his fingers on the grip of his pulse rifle and drew in a breath. He let it out slowly as he focused his mind. Instantly, the dull ache of the Garm presence in his mind was there. He breathed again and concentrated, letting his physical senses take in what was around him, including the movement in the bayou ahead. He could feel the Garm out there, the pulse of alien life, sliding against the edges of his consciousness, though it was a distant thing, almost faint. "I don't know. There's a kind of static that is layered over my sense of the beasts," stammered Jorah, working swiftly to acclimatize to the radically new sensations that were divergent from his only slightly less new awareness of the alien presence. "Almost like too many people talking at once, making it impossible to hear one voice."
"The Garm only have one voice," observed Hart, pausing in his forward march to toggle his rangefinder. "Something is wrong." Now the sniper was talking about it. Jorah agreed with him, as if he'd been aware of it since making Planetfall, but it wasn't until he was out in the thick wilderness did he recognize it for what it was. In past raids, the Horde broods were like beacons to his mind, and Jorah, along with the other hounds, were able to move on instinct directly into contact with enemy elements. It usually turned into a race to fight their way through the defenders and destroy the ship before it could launch.
and yet here the static was obscuring everything. If it had been over his headset, the Marine would have sworn his comms were being jammed. Then it hit him. Jammed. The thick foliage of the bayou parted, and two uniformed men emerged from the tangle of vegetation. They bore the deep blue uniforms of Odessan security forces, though they were covered in blood, and the fabric was tattered from tears and rips. They fell to their knees at the sight of scores of armored Marines trudging through the swamp, and Jorah acknowledged that any man unprepared to witness 200 or more pulse rifles pointed in his direction would fall to his knees. Jorah tapped two of his men to press forward and secure the security staffers, and he turned to Hart. "You saw them long before they emerged," stated Jorah, as he slowly moved forward in formation with the rest of his warriors. "Were you testing me? Seeing if I'd pick up on Garm following close behind?" "Partially. I have been notified through the Scald channel that the penal facility in this quadrant has gone radio silent. There was a raid in progress along with a UHC response." "All non-responsive," answered Hart. "I was not fully convinced that those two men were, in fact, men at all. Thank you for the confirmation." Jorah said nothing but checked his field map to see that the facility was only a few miles distant. He could see that one of the fleeing men had already expired, having bled out from what Jorah could now see were multiple gunshot wounds. The other was babbling somewhat incoherently about men that weren't men, though his words slurred into silence as the sedatives administered by the medic kicked in. "Apologies, sirs," said the medic to Jorah and Hart. "It was knock him out or risk him exerting himself to the point of death. He's been severely injured, but I've got the internal bleeding addressed, just have to keep him stable." "Stretcher him and port him at the rear of the formation," Jorah said. And then, as the Marine went about his duties, the Marine turned to Hart. "Men that are not men?" "Let us make haste to this facility, before whatever nightmare is unfolding has ended, leaving us with only questions and corpses," answered Hart, before he slung his rifle and began double-time marching through the muck in the direction of the facility. Jorah motioned for his men to follow, and as word traveled down the line, Gorgon Company began pushing through the bayou. After a swift mile, Jorah was able to hear the muffled crack of gunshots and knew they were getting close. The sound would have been much sharper had the fighting been outdoors. As it was, the Marine realized that most of what he was hearing had to be of indoor fighting, indicating that whatever was happening inside the prison wasn't over yet. The Marines closed in on the facility. Just as they were able to see the outer edges of the rooftop sticking out above the swampy tree line, a flight of ravens soared over them. In seconds, the shooting started, and this time it was loud and clear. "Contact! Contact!" came the call of the lead raven, and the throaty roar of pulse rifles joined with the higher-pitched staccato of conventional small arms. "Shooters in the towers and on the walls! UHC troopers pinned down on the launch yard!" "Copy, Raven. Neutralize the towers and we'll come through the wall," responded Jorah, thumbing the activator on his pulse rifle, his heart surging as the gun's plasma core thrummed to life. "Fire team, Theta, on me!" The Marines burst out of the thick swamp and stormed across the open ground between the murky tree line and the outer wall of the southern end of the complex. Their approach was anything but silent as the men splashed noisily through the shallow water that surrounded the complex. Jorah could see clouds of 3-inch-long leeches swirling through the churning water and was thankful that none of them seemed able to graft onto his armor. Had a man without plate armor, like an escaping prisoner, tried to cross the 50-yard-wide leech moat, they'd have been overwhelmed. The Marine would not have been surprised to discover a skeleton or two half buried in the mud, the remains of men who had tried and died. On his left, a raven streaked across the sky, blazing away with its mounted pulse rifle, and the cement guard tower, which was really just a glorified sniper's perch, exploded in a rain of debris. On his right, a figure in the tower fired a carbine rifle at the raven. The flyer banked hard and disappeared over the other side of the wall, and Jorah could not tell if the man had been hit or not. The Marine raised his rifle to return fire when a loud report rang out and the man with the carbine fell from the tower as his head exploded from a high-velocity projectile passing through it. Jorah had two thoughts at that moment. The first was that Hart had slipped away without him noticing and set up a sniper position somewhere behind the tree line. The second was that the corpse that fell from the tower did not look quite right.
He didn't have time to dwell on the thought, however, as the concrete wall loomed tall in front of him, topped with several more apparently human shooters. His men began exchanging fire with the defenders as the fire team moved forward, and Jorah winced as one of his men collapsed in a heap from several well-placed carbine rounds to the throat. Such was the cost of blitz tactics, though Jorah was certain he and the rest of his team would make good.
"Bring it down! Follow my line!" shouted Jorah,
and he began firing bolts into the wall, starting at the base of it just above the water and working his way to the top, marking where he wanted his men to fire. As he did, another boom came from the swamp, and a shooter above was carried backward and out of sight from a high-velocity round. As more Marines focused on the wall, the Scald sniper dropped a third wall defender, giving the Marines a reprieve from the hail of bullets. Two men of Gorgon were now lying on the open ground, each one now covered in a writhing mass of leeches and insects, as the swamp rose up to claim its latest meal. A dozen other Marines opened up, and the superheated plasma tore and burned great chunks out of the wall. The prison complex was built to handle the harsh weather of the planet and keep prisoners inside. It was not built to cope with the concentrated fire of pulse rifles and yielded quickly under the sustained punishment. A second fire team joined them, and as Jorah's men vented their weapons, the next group of Marines pounded the widening gap in the wall. Jorah racked the slide of his rifle and sprinted forward as soon as there was a space wide enough for him to fit through, blown from the formerly solid piece of concrete. Had the Odessa Corporation thought the facility would suffer such an assault, they might have used a rebar skeleton for the wall instead of just a prefabricated slab of cheap concrete that stood upright. The Marine leaped through the gap and sprinted into the landing yard, sweeping his rifle back and forth across his field of vision. There were two UHC troopships in the launch yard, one of them buried nose down in the ground at a steep angle, enough to reveal that many of the troops inside had been crushed on impact. The other, thankfully, was in a standard landing position, though both mounted guns were silent, each with a dead gunner strapped to the mount. The landing yard was littered with bodies, a mixture of convicts, security staffers, UHC troopers, and something else. Five UHC troopers were still alive, pinned down on Jorah's side of the troopship. Now that Ravens were making strafing runs, and Hart's rifle continued its steady song, much of the outer walls and towers were cleared of hostile shooters. Jorah pounded across the landing yard as he and his Marines laid down fire against the central guard tower, the remaining threat to the exposed troopers and Marines. It was reinforced with armor and had several gun ports, though the punishing fire from Marines and Ravens had temporarily silenced the guns. Whoever was inside had taken cover behind the already bent and smoldering armor, though at any moment they could emerge again and fire on the exposed Marines.
"On your feet, troopers!" shouted Jorah as he rushed past the crouching UHC men. "We have to clear this area!"
The Marine leveled his rifle at the main access door and drove several bolts through the hinges and lock. He did not want to chance being exposed any longer than they were, especially if the shooters in the tower had anything heavier than the carbines they'd been using. He was already three Marines down, and there was no telling what awaited them within the compound. Jorah vented his weapon as he ran. Two Marines sprinted past him to hurl themselves shoulder first into the doors. He brought his rifle up just as the Marines battered the doors off their hinges. He turned on his mounted light and plunged into the darkness within. Jorah's lights displayed a primary corridor painted in an off-white that almost glowed in the illumination from the Marine's weapon and body lights. More Marines poured in behind him and used their pulse rifles to blast away the barred metal sets of doors, all three that were designed to manage the flow of convicts to and from the yard. If the hostile shooters had hoped to hold the facility, they were in for a significant disappointment. Jorah moved into the central chamber of the prison complex, where he could see that there had indeed been a riot. However, as he looked more closely, it appeared to have gotten much more violent, more like a battlefield. Blood and gore were everywhere, though not a single body in sight.
"Fan out in pairs, sweep the facility," said Jorah as more and more Marines began to pour into the compound.
He knew he should acknowledge the UHC troopers, though as they entered the chamber it was clear that they were still in a state of shock. Jorah had to remind himself that most human soldiers had not seen much combat outside the occasional police action or separatist insurrection, and both were usually rather short-lived. Hart appeared by his side, the Scald not even breathing heavily, despite his likely sprint across the distance.
"No bodies. But perhaps an indication of where they were taken, said the sniper flatly, as he pointed towards several thick smears of blood. Once Jorah saw the smears, he began to realize that there were a great many of them, all leading in the direction of the mess hall, as indicated by the signage on the wall. Reports started coming back of empty cells and evidence of hard, close-quarter fighting as Marines filled the seemingly empty facility, and Jorah's hackles raised. I have no sense of the Garm here. The presence is weak and that static, yet more potent, growled Jorah, as he raised his rifle and started moving along the path left by the smeared blood. Those shooters were not entirely human, said Hart as he slung his sniper rifle and slid his sidearm from its holster while he followed the Marine. Something in the way they moved, the shape of them as they died, it feels familiar despite being so odd. Maybe we have seen this before, mused Jorah as he signaled for a fire team of four Marines to join him and the sniper. On Tancred. I cannot say for sure, but I feel that familiarity. The fire team moved through the bent metal of the caged doors that led out of the central chamber and then found themselves in a massive cell block. The signage insisted that the mess hall was at the other end. As the Marines moved into the cell block, the doors at the other end burst open, and the shock of what came out of them forced even the hardened Marines of Gorgon Company to hesitate. Scald Hart suffered no such pause, snapping his pistol up to fire three tightly packed rounds into the chest of this new nightmare confronting them. The monster still had pieces of a convict's jumpsuit clinging to its warped flesh, and if a human and a ripper drone could be combined in the body of the same creature, this was what the Marines now looked upon. The Scald's rounds punched into the unarmored meat of the beast's chest, and in a flash of gore, the thing exploded. Jorah blinked as he noticed how the hands of another conflict flapped weakly against the outer edge of the scything bioblades that appeared to have emerged from inside the man's body. It was as if the Ripper drone had grown inside the human, and finally, too large for the casing of human flesh to hold it in, had burst through and merged with its host. Sickeningly, the face, while marred with hinged mandibles and jet-black eyes, was still human-looking. The fire team unleashed a wall of bolts that filled the cell block and turned the swarm of hybrid human Garm abominations into a churning mass of shattered bodies and flailing limbs. They were not armored the way Ripper drones were, and the superheated plasma projectiles were devastating. As the Marines paused to vent their weapons, more shooting sounded behind them as the entire complex was suddenly bursting with the hybrid creatures. "Arrow on me," snarled Jorah. His previous hesitation and terror swiftly replaced by a growing fury at the hideous implications of what he was witnessing. Purge this compound, Marines! Nothing lives! The fireteam tried not to look too closely at the corpses they stepped over, wanting to spare themselves too much of an intimate view of the abhorrence before them. It was a vain tactic. When they entered the mess, they discovered what had become of those convicts who apparently were not hybrid creatures. It was a sickening bit of humor, thought Jorah, that these creatures had turned the mess hall into a charnel house, filled with piles of half-eaten flesh. The Marines recognized it as evidence of a mass combat feeding, a Garm war tactic that was sometimes witnessed during protracted engagements when the Garm organisms needed to top up their caloric reserves in between attack waves. Sudden gunfire rang out, the sharp crack of carbines and the resultant muzzle flash lighting up the dismal room. The fire team hurled themselves behind the metal serving counter as a group of men rushed them from an access door that led to the staff quarters and security supply chambers. The men all appeared to be wearing Odessa security outfits, like the hostile shooters outdoors, and they all carried the carbines that Jorah realized must have been standard issue from Odessa Corp. One of the Marines didn't make it to the counter as he was struck in the leg from the first salvo, then peppered with rounds as the enemy spread out into the room. Jorah returned fire, blasting one of the men off his feet. Hart worked his pistol fluidly and dropped two more of the enemy before ducking back into cover. More Marines came in from the cell block, and Jorah's fire team caught the hostiles in a crossfire that wiped them out in seconds. Jorah came around the counter as all clear reports came in from across the compound. The hybrids with the bioblades were apparently just as single-minded and suicidal as the Ripper drones they so resembled, but without the speed and body armor that made them so deadly. Marines had died,
and though Jorah was saddened to receive casualty reports, not nearly as many perished as would have had these hybrids been Rippers. The Marine walked up to the body of one of the hostile shooters and looked down upon it. The man had taken a round in the throat from Hart, and it appeared to have killed him. As Jorah peered closer, noticing the man's eyes were the same jet black as the Berserker hybrids, the man's face split apart at the jaws, garm mandibles bursting forth, and he sprang up from the ground. The flesh of his arm parted bloodily, and a bioblade slid out, unfolding in the double-jointed way that the Ripper drones would when attacking. The beast was fast, taking advantage of Jorah's momentary shock to sink the bioblade into the meat of his thigh. Jonah was just as fast, though, and his pulse rifle roared, obliterating the beast's skull. Jorah fell to the blood-slick floor, wounded but not fatally so. Hart and another Marine helped him up and pumped him with a stimulant while the medic applied an anticoagulant. Jonah found that he almost did not notice the attention of the other men. He just kept looking at the bodies of the shooters.
"Men who are not men," said Hart, his voice just above a whisper, and Jorah's blood ran cold.
7. Third Shift. Gunnar woke up from a rather fitful sleep as the speakers embedded into the ceiling called all men to their battle stations. His eyes were sticky as he blinked the sleep from them, and he swiftly applied moisture drops with a practiced hand. Gunnar's eyes no longer produced tears, one of the handful of unpredictable side effects the Body Forge had on shunts like him. Shunts, thought Gunnar, as the lights in the barracks strobed red and the other 20 men who shared this berth with him roused themselves, was a dirty word. It was a bit of self-deprecating slang that Gunnar and the men like him sometimes used to describe themselves. No space marine would ever say that to Gunnar's face. Ever the honorable infantry, those immortal bastards, yet he knew some of them thought it, just as he did. Gunnar tugged a service vest over his duty shirt and then leaned down to lace up his deck boots. The rest of the men in the barracks did the same, transforming themselves from weary men, sleeping soundly, to the sharp third shift crew of Battery 12. They might not have what it took to stand in the mud with rifles and fight the Garm one-on-one, but that did not mean they were not without use. When Gunnar stood up and stepped over to the edge of his bunk, he was joined by 20 others who were just as fast, just as ready, as he was. The hatch to the barracks opened, and the men nearest it turned sharply on their heels and marched out of the chamber. There was a discipline to their movements, even here in their sleeping quarters, and it would be more so once they reached their duty station. Routine was critical for such men with their myriad of mental and physical side effects of failure in the Body Forge, as it encouraged them to push past such things in service to humanity. Shunts were the multitudes of volunteers who joined the army of the Allfather yet were found wanting when placed in the crucible of the Body Forge. Less than Marines, yet more than men. At least, that was the saying. And most of the time, Gunnar agreed. The legions of Einherjar were vast, with Marines fighting the Garm invaders on 1,000 battlefields across the universe every day. The warriors of humanity died all the time and found themselves reborn in the Body Forge. Recycled soldiers being hurled into combat on an endless loop, and it was barely enough to keep the ravenous aliens held back. The United Humanity Coalition had relied on volunteers to fill the levies for the Allfather's army, and though recruitment had been on a steady decline once the Extinction Fleet was fought to a stalemate, many men still answered the call. Not all of us were born to carry a rifle, thought Gunnar, as he and the rest of the men rushed down the hallway, swift yet orderly, towards the hatch for Battery 12. He had been such a man, a volunteer from the slums of Hittia. His skin still bore the crude tattoos of his time as a gangster in that urban nightmare, a reminder of who he used to be. That was perhaps both a blessing and a curse in Gunnar's mind, as the Marines tended to lose a part of their identity with every fresh resurrection. He would always be Gunnar, a widower, a criminal, an absent father, just another hideous lowlife. He had come to the Allfather a broken man, ready to give himself to the cause, to atone for his lifetime of ill deeds by making corpses of the Garm. He wanted to forget, but the Body Forge would not allow it. He was a resurrection reject,
A shunt. There was a reason that resurrection technology was something reserved for the armies of the Allfather and none other amongst the UHC. It was an imperfect process, mostly due to the frailty of the human psyche being out of balance with the hardiness and mutability of the human body. Gunnar did not presume to know anything about resurrection science, but from what he'd gathered, the minds of most men rejected the reality of resurrection. The Body Forge engaged with the human mind in a quantum state, a cauldron of probability in which the collective memories that yielded a man's consciousness and identity awaited. The torques were customized for each individual, and for most men, when the chemicals of the forge brought them into that trance-like quantum state, their minds were unwilling to accept the consequences of endless death and rebirth. The official line was that in order to be a Marine who could rise and fall with the Body Forge, a man must meet specific and yet highly classified criteria. Women, for whatever reason, had a 100% rejection rate. Some theorized it had something to do with their ability to create life. It was a complex synchronicity of physiology and psychology that allowed those destined to become Marines to endure the resurrection with their sanity, mostly, intact. To Gunnar, it was all fuzzy science that went far beyond his simple compulsory education. He realized he understood it in only the broadest of terms, but what he did know was that most people thought it was a man's soul that rejected the Body Forge, not the other way around. In the quantum state, many believed, a man's soul was faced with the reality of being a single consciousness that was copied and recopied onto a vat-grown brain that controlled a vat-grown body. The real you died the first time, and whatever came out of the forge afterward was just a copy of you, and every time you resurrected, that copy got more and more flawed. Gunnar tried not to dwell on it too much, and when his mind was in the quantum state, the denial of resurrection had been firm and extreme. That was the part nobody liked to talk about, the trauma of entering the quantum state and then rejecting the procedure. The torques would melt on their platforms, and the men would rise screaming from the thick nutrient soup of the coffin-like resurrection pods. That violent rejection came with a cost. For Gunnar, it wasn't just the inability to produce tears, but also severe brain trauma. He, like so many others, emerged without much in the way of a sense of taste, smell, or the ability to fully read the emotions of others. Some men, even a few of his current crew, had lost the ability to speak on top of everything else. For every Marine who could cope with the Body Forge, there were hundreds of shunts who could not. And these broken men became the support elements of the Einherjar military. They were the mechanics, cooks, ship's crew, and gun servants. Many came looking for glory, and most found only sacrifice and toil. Such was the grim cost demanded by the Allfather and the wolf at the gate, or so it was said. "Third shift, on the ready line," barked the voice of Jarl Edwin, the harsh master of batteries 10 to 15. As Gunnar and the others mustered on the gun deck after pouring in through the hatch, Jarl Edwin began walking up and down their ranks. He always did this, the sizing up of each crew member before they took to the gun. While third shift, Gunnar's current group, was mostly comprised of hardened veterans, it was Edwin's way to treat everyone as if it was their first day. "Brave men of the Bifrost," Edwin said, his powerful voice vibrating against the walls of the gun deck, a sloping chamber devoted to housing the four anti-air weapon system that comprised Battery 12. "The wolves have returned for another assault on our ramparts. Apparently, they got a taste of Battery 12 and want some more." The joke was a cruel one, as Third Shift had lost 7 men only a month prior, during a probing assault by several Garm spine frigates. The 3 ships had been focused on destroying gun batteries aboard the Bifrost, as opposed to the expected all-out assault that was more common. Usually, the spine frigates would swap artillery salvos with human guns, while other types of ships either tried to assault the fortress with boarding parties or slip through the blockade altogether. Or at least that was what Gunnar had been told, as for the majority of his military career, the Garm had been launching small strikes against a wider array of targets. For the last 4 years or so, the Garm had been doing things differently.
The hive mind had shifted its tactics, which alone was a terrifying fact to consider, and was launching multitudes of small attacks along the battlefield instead of focusing all its might upon massive assaults, usually against the Bifrost. Gunnar knew, like every other warrior in the Allfather's army, Einherjar and Shunt alike, that the conventional Garm tactic was to assault the strongest enemy element first and work its way down the line. The strongest point in the human battlefront was the Star Fortress Bifrost, named after the mystical bridge of ancient North mythology that connected the realm of the gods with the realm of men. Gunnar remembered the titanic space battle which had been his first as a crew member that had occurred roughly 5 years ago, when the mighty Ajax of Hydra Company, a legend among the support crews as much as he was with his fellow Marines, was battling Grendel on Hiorot. The hive mind dispatched a great force to break the Bifrost. That force had failed. And Gunnar remembered with crystal clarity the haunting sight of so many broken enemy ships floating in the void, the surviving attackers already cannibalizing the dead and dragging their corpses back into the darkness of Garm space. "We've had it easy, lads. For years, the hive mind has only seen fit to hit us with small attack groups. The Watchman, may he be ever vigilant, determines that these have been screens for their supply raids," said Jarl Edwin as he checked the last of the crew and came to stand in front of Gunnar, looking into the man's eyes as he spoke to the room. "Some of you remember what it was like to take on an entire star swarm, and you know as well as I do that every skirmish since then has been weak tea. Take heed, gentlemen. The Einherjar did their best to stop the raids, but they couldn't catch all of them," growled Edwin as he turned away from Gunnar and approached the command lectern so that he could activate the viewports. As the void shields parted to reveal the vast emptiness of Garm space in front of them, he added, "Out there, a fleet of ships is coming for us. Flight trajectory puts them on a collision course with the Bifrost inside an hour. Whatever they were gobbling up supplies to feed has finally hatched. I will be in circulation between batteries, and armsmen have been stationed at every hatch in the event of a boarding action. Gunnar, the deck is yours. Good hunting." "Good hunting, sir," responded Gunnar, his voice nearly cracking from the surge of adrenaline roaring through his system. "Third shift, man your battle stations." Jarl Edwin nodded curtly and left the deck as men scrambled to their various posts. Gunnar thought he was a serviceable deck chief, a low-level command element that lived and fought alongside his small crew, even if he had risen to the post over the bodies of better men. Battery 12 had taken a beating during that titanic conflict years ago, and the only two crew to survive were Gunnar and Mateo, the lead trigger man. While the void seals had held, preventing massive decompression, several direct hits from a spine frigate had wiped out the crew. "Spine frigates," shuddered Gunnar at the memory, even as he fed